If you're a farmer in New York State, join the New York State Grown and Certified program to let people know your food is grown right, right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
I'm Tim Gunn, author, educator, and Project Runway mentor, and you're listening to Heritage Radio.
Welcome to the second season of Magnifico Radio, the weekly podcast featuring conversations in ethical fashion, clean beauty, and sustainable living. I'm your host, Kate Black, and if you're listening live on Heritage Radio Network, that means it's Monday at 1 o'clock here in Brooklyn. And welcome. And if you found us through iTunes or Stitcher, welcome to you too. I hope you don't forget to subscribe. Each week I sit down with designers, makers, and leaders in sustainability to discuss the latest in ethical fashion, clean beauty, and sustainable living. This podcast is an extension of my blog, Magnifico.com. That's Magnifico.com. And my book, also called Magnifico, Your Head-to-Toe Guide to Ethical Fashion and Non-Toxic Beauty. When it comes to ethical fashion, many look to foreign production as one of the sources of the problem. In the 1960s, 98% of our clothes were made domestically. And in fact, 95% of it was made right here in New York City's Garment Center. And today, that number has decreased to 3%. Can Made in the USA be a reality for brands new and old? I'm joined by fashion designer and production process consultant Anthony LaLore to discuss domestic manufacturing and the future. Welcome, Anthony.
Thank you.
Thanks, so nice to see you.
Yeah, nice to see you again.
So I read this stat. I know you're a big fan of stats, so let's just jump right into the numbers. So I read, if consumers spend 1% or more on U.S. goods, they could create 200,000 jobs. Is that true for apparel, do you think?
Wow. That's, I don't know. Yeah, maybe.
Okay, let me frame it a different way.
How much do they spend now?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. But let me just ask you, is it a problem of supply or demand? What's the issue about made in America?
It's a pretty complex issue. A lot of it has to do with price, obviously, or maybe not obviously. And the actual product being made here, there just isn't as much of it made in the United States as there was, as you said, back in the 60s and during the growth of the middle class.
And so we offshored because for a myriad of reasons, political, financial,
pricing.
But now that we've had this focus to kind of bring it back, are we seeing it coming back? Is that a thing? Can you bring manufacturing back?
I think the framing of it as coming back is part of the problem. The horse is out of the barn. I don't know that it's coming back. What I think needs to be focused on is, can it be started again here? Can it be made here? And so much of that depends on the willingness of the audience to buy the product that's made, or the ability of the audience to buy the product that's made.
And I heard that it's actually multi-layered, because when manufacturing went offshore, the factories either took the merchandise or took the machines, or they sold them. But by and large, most of them are obsolete, right? We're talking 30 years of technology advances. So do we have even the technological resources here to bring manufacturing back?
Yes and no. The yes part of it is sewing basically hasn't changed since the invention of the, you know, like the Singer type sewing machine. There's still a lot of work that can be done using those machines. The no part of it is the CAD machines, the computer assisted design and development component of it. There's a fair amount of them, but not like in the large institutional factories offshore. Unless you go to, some large institutional factories here, but those factories are they're primarily full. they're full of work already because of their ability to produce at scale.
So this is a question, because when we do eco sessions and we have this conversation about domestic production, we've had one in Toronto, we had one in LA. And so this question of capacity makes everybody get a little bit edgy. And I'm not sure why, because it's true, isn't it, that we're at capacity?
In a lot of factories, I believe we are.
And so why is that an anxious kind of conversation? Because nobody wants to turn work away?
No, I think it actually has more to do with people seeing scale as part of the problem. Fast fashion produces at, number one, a rapid rate. Number two, very high volumes at that rapid rate. So the correlation can be made that if you're making a lot of something, it's bad. I think if you're making a lot of something that's good, it's good.
Okay. And then the capacity, because we had conversations, because I know for a client, you were trying to help them do domestic production, and you were running into all of these issues where you couldn't actually fit them in, because nobody could fit them in, because military gets priority.
A lot of the military programs are very big. The companies that do get them, I think, get contracts for 3 or 5 years. The difference between a military contract and, say, a large scale, whether it's Gap or somebody like that, is, you know, the military contracts, you run the same thing in the same colors. You basically don't even change thread colors. Fashion, even if you're only doing 5 basic colors, black, navy, khaki, gray, light gray, white, something like that, you're still changing threads. Not that changing threads is such a big deal, but it's a change. And what happens with the military contracts is a group of people in a production line learn a series of operations, and they work toward bettering themselves and bettering the process and the percentage. If they're priced out as being able to make 10 pieces in 10 minutes, if they make 11 pieces in 10 minutes, they're operating at 110%, and that's good for them and it's good for the factory. Cover it?
But I thought also that you had told me that military contracts have to take precedence because of the way that we've set that up, that all military are going to be made in the U.S., so that when an order comes in, I thought it wasn't necessarily just choice. I thought some factories actually needed to move apparel over so that they could make room for...
Well, if they have military contracts, they certainly don't want to bring something in that's going to, you know, jeopardize it.
Right.
And the fact that the military product, it has to be very compliant, meaning that it complies with the laws or rules set up by, I don't know, Senator Berry. I don't remember really what his name is, but it's Berry. And it means that the stuff has to be manufactured domestically. So if you have that contract, you can't jeopardize it by bringing something else in.
But that's something that we never really talk about, right? Like when we look at fashion or ethical fashion, we don't actually take into consideration that all military clothing is made at home. Like, that should be one thing that is celebrated a little bit, or something that's
hugely
considered as, you know, domestic production and domestic manufacturing providing the jobs that the stat that I threw at you in the opening monologue is, you know, so making jobs and producing jobs. So if What would happen if we had more military? Like, what happens if in this government we, what happens if we go back to war? What's going to happen to domestic manufacturing?
It's actually good for domestic manufacturing. The mills get more work, more factories can be set up to take on the overflow. It's unfortunately, war is good for business. Philosophically, I don't like the idea of it, but.
So let's talk about New York City and the garment district.
Yeah.
So what's happening here in, it's a real estate play, right? As it is in a lot of places. Everybody wants the land for something else, maybe lofts, condos, something a little bit more sexy than a manufacturing facility. So is that still a reality here in New York City?
Sure it is. And I don't fault the landlords for wanting to make money. That's their business. I fault them for not complying with zoning laws and the rules that are set up to operate within the district. But if you can rent space at $50 a square foot to an internet company or doctor's offices or lawyers or architects or whatever it is, other than manufacturing, why would you want to keep a manufacturing facility in there that's paying $18 or $20 a square foot?
Yeah, it's a financial thing.
It's a financial thing.
And so who, so what?
In part, it's okay. A financial thing.
And what's the other part?
I think certain administrations that we've had over the years are more interested in service jobs and tourism and stuff like that than they are in manufacturing in New York City, or especially Manhattan, New York City, when I say.
Yeah, I feel like that is changing. I feel like the more that we see the news, the more that we see problems in supply chains abroad, the more we see examples of Rana Plaza, and now with the current administration talking about reshoring jobs, not necessarily apparel, but just reshoring jobs, I feel like we're in a very momentous moment for apparel, for brands who want to produce here. And so my bigger question is maybe like, so if all the brands that wanted to produce here brought their business home, could they do it?
Probably not. And for a couple of reasons. One is the available skilled workforce. To the space available to do that in. And three, related to the first one, we really can't manufacture some things the same way domestically as they can be manufactured offshore. And a big part of that is price and labor.
And so we have specialties here versus abroad. Like, what are we good at? Like, what can you, you're a young fashion brand, you move to New York, you're like, okay, I'm going to start my brand. What are we good at?
The New York City Garment Center is great at development. It's great at idea generation. It's great at the network of the system. I don't mean to be so esoteric about that, but within the confines of the Garment Center, and it's not just the Garment Center, it's primarily the Garment Center proper, but within the confines of the Garment Center, you have design, you have sales, you have pattern making, draping, sample making, production, all the different trims, the fabrics, the marketing teams. You have all of these interconnected parts in one location. In a lot of cases, on the same block, maybe even in the same building. That's unbelievable. Selfishly, I love that neighborhood for that reason. To manufacture in New Jersey, if your office is in Midtown Manhattan, yeah, okay, it's a transportation away. It's not the same as getting on a plane and flying halfway around the world. The same can be said of manufacturing in Brooklyn or other parts, other boroughs. There's a convenience level. And it's not a laziness convenience. It's an opportunity convenience. If something goes wrong, and it always does, you're down the block. You're 5 minutes away. You can, as a young designer, you walk those streets. You're in and out of those buildings. It's very efficient.
That's awesome. Okay, let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
New York State cares about New York's farmers. That's why we've developed the New York State Grown and Certified program. It's a seal New Yorkers can look for when they're shopping for food that comes from local farms. Customers are more likely to buy food that has the New York State Grown and Certified seal because it tells them that it comes from a farm that follows environmentally responsible, farm-safe protocols. In other words, the New York State Grown and Certified seal tells them their food is grown right, right here in New York State. You're a farmer with a lot to do, but the time it takes to sign up for the program is a great investment for your business because it lets shoppers know that your food meets higher standards, has passed assessments, and is produced by environmentally friendly farming practices. To learn about participating in the program, go to certified.ny.gov.
And we're back. You're listening to Magnifico Radio, and I'm your host, Kate Black, and I'm here today with Anthony LaLore, fashion designer and production procurement consultant. Anthony, you've been designing in New York City for over 30 years. Did you go to school?
I did.
Which one?
I went to Parsons School of Design.
Nice. Yeah. And you told me a lovely story the other day, which just kind of, I'm surprised we've been friends for so long, and it just kind of came out, and you're like, oh, did I ever tell you how I chose Parsons? My cousin Grace, would you like to kind of just give me the brief rundown for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. My family names of Italian descent, LaLore on my father's and father's father's side, and Mirabella on my father's mother's side. Grace Mirabella, editor of Vogue magazine for many years after Diana Vreeland and before Anna Wintour, is my father's cousin. So when I was in school, not Parsons, Villanova, I had decided that the trajectory of law or doctor or architect or something like that wasn't really right for me. So I told my parents that I wanted to get involved in fashion design. They were concerned about it a little bit, but I explained it as a mix of art and commerce, which I, to this day, believe. The art and the self-expression component of it, I like. So my father said, well, I don't know anything about that industry. He's a lawyer. So you know, finish school and we'll figure out what you have to do, where you have to go to school. Let's get in touch with Grace and see what she says. So he called up Grace Mirabella, and she said, well, send him in to the office. So here I am thinking, wow, I'm going into fashion and I'm going to have a meeting with the editor of Vogue magazine. So I get to her office, and obviously I knew her through family events, but it was a bit distant. So she asked me who I liked, and I told her I liked Calvin Klein and I liked John Anthony. She said, well, they're two completely different things. And I said, well, they are, but they're not. There are two ends of the spectrum, but there's a beautiful simplicity to both of them. So she said, oh, okay, I get that. Let's see what they say. So she picked up the phone and, you know, dialed Calvin. Hey, it's Grace. My cousin is here in the office. He wants to get involved in fashion. What do I tell him? He said, well, tell him to come spend a day with me. So she made the arrangement, and she did the same thing with John Anthony. So I went and I spent a morning with Calvin and an afternoon with John. And you know, Calvin said go to FIT, and John said go to Parsons. And the sensibility of Parsons for me at the time seemed more right. So that's what I shot for. And fortunately, I got in and made it through the program. And
It's so fun. Of course, in New York, everybody has a story,
yeah,
right?
Well.
And then you worked as a designer for a long time. Then you launched your own label with your wife,
yeah.
Restore NYC,
yeah.
Which was like one of the very first from almost seed to shelf, ethically fashioned, sustainable apparel lines.
Right.
You guys launched in 2007?
Yeah, a little earlier than that. I mean, we were conjuring it up in 2004 and 2005. We had a business that designed and manufactured clothing for the cosmetic and fragrance industry, doing the uniforms that are worn by the men and women that work behind counter. So some of what we were doing was made domestically and some of it was offshore. The stuff that we couldn't make, like sweaters and things like that, that we couldn't make right in the neighborhood, we made where we could. And then the rest of it, that's the garment center, and that's what it was. That's what we did there. So we noticed that there was a real inconsistency with what we were doing and what we were actually thinking and living. And what we were doing was we were making tons of product that was being used as a promotional piece and then discarded, or something was being done with it. We had no control over it at that point. But we were living in a much more sustainable mindset, and the two didn't jive. So we started looking around for what kind of materials and fibers can we introduce and at least offer as a solution, as a variation. And it turns out the stuff was just too expensive for these promotional things. And one of the ones that kind of sent us over the edge was a promotion for one of the fragrance brands, and we made I think 30,000 banners and 17,000 tablecloths, and it was just an enormous for us, an enormous order. But it was the equivalent of 20 or 30 miles of fabric. It's an enormous amount of fabric that was going to be used for a promotion. And then, they were dumb polyester tablecloths that had a logo on it. So they got thrown in the trash. We started thinking, geez, I mean, we're throwing away 25, 30 miles of fabric. So there's got to be something better. So we started to find stuff. And one of the companies that was open to the idea was Exhale Spa, They had one location at the time, and we pitched an organic Supima cotton micromodal spandex blend, a rib for a tank top. And it was, you know, it was just beautiful fabric if you get off on that kind of thing. More expensive than they would have normally spent. But there was the sustainability component of it that fit with their mind-body spa thing, and it fit with ours. And that kind of launched us in this new direction. There was also a change taking place in the spa and cosmetic side toward cosmeceuticals, the blend of just better type product, better image, better message. So with that, we decided that that's really the direction that we want to start to focus. We kept the business doing what it was doing, and because it was generating money, and it gave us the opportunity to start Restore. So we had Restore Clothing, with Restore being an acronym. Responsible, earth-friendly, sustainable, technological, organic, recycled, and ergonomic. And we built this really tight box that we wanted everything to fit into. Thinking along the lines of constraint actually being a driver of creativity, much the same way it is in a sonnet or opera or symphonies. There's a box that you fit into. And it turned out to be very good for us for a while. And I say a while because it was too tight a box. We could have done things differently and still fit the mold. Striving for perfection is great if you're willing to accept excellent.
Well, and it was at the time when really the visionaries were coming to light, like people who really thought that brands and businesses could be done in a different way, right? Like
right.
I put you kind of on the level of Richard Branson in terms of your like overarching vision.
Well, then
like,
maybe next time we'll have this conversation on my private island or his private island.
I mean, maybe he made some different choices, but there was kind of a singularity in the way that you guys launched that line, and there's a singularity that rode through how you think about design and how you think about production, and I just think I always find it really inspiring.
Thank
because
you.
You're welcome. Because I think that you're a big believer in what could be. You're a big proponent of what should be. You have this kind of moral compass about like we don't need to cut corners when it's very easy just to do the right thing the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is all genuine and really respectful. So what happened to Restore? Also the economy, right?
Yeah, that had something to do with it. We couldn't scale it the way it needed to scale, and it required more of an investment than we were capable of making. So we just closed it as a line and kept it open as a consultancy, where we've taken the network and the relationships that we built and kind of mixed that into other brands, into consulting gigs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is great because I know that you teach at FIT. You teach.
I do.
People get you for very cheap when they take your class on, what's it called?
Navigating Sustainable Design and Manufacturing.
There you go. So anybody who's looking for a very affordable but illuminating course at FIT, you should take that. And then so you take all of the experience that you had with Restore, sustainable textiles, kind of the fit and the wear and the durability, coupled with all of your extensive knowledge about domestic manufacturing and help other brands.
I do. And I think the important takeaway on that is that it's more about the questions and less about the answers. So if you come to the class looking for answers, don't waste your money. Google the answer. But if you're more interested in learning about why and what the questions are to get to the answer. That's how I teach navigation.
And then in your private practice with your clients?
Same thing.
Okay.
Yeah. Obviously, what I try to bring to the table is an area of expertise or a level of expertise, but it's also a coaching and a guidance to help them figure out the answers that are best for their business. Yes, of course, I make introductions and bring things to the table, but there's also a big Q&A that goes on. With design questioning first the end result. Where do you want it to be and what do you want that product to be next? What's as part of the circular economy, what happens to the product that you're going to make? We just make too much stuff. There's a lot of people, but we make too much stuff.
So, which circles us back to domestic manufacturing. So, right. if people made things more, if designers and brands made things more thoughtfully or a little bit, with longevity at its heart, do you think that we have a future in domestic manufacturing? Do you think we can not bring the original horse back, but we can actually have a stable again?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's a little too lofty to think that everything will be that way, because even though everybody has to wear clothing, you don't have to buy new clothing. And in a lot of cases, you can't afford to buy new clothing. It's more important to have food and medicine and shelter. So the thinking should become the necessity of the clothing as art and commerce, as a representation of who you are, and that should not be confused with who you are keeping up with the Joneses, having a new dress to go to the party. Oh, I can't go to the second party in the same dress. So.
Awesome. And so if people wanted to hire you or find out more about your contract business or contract you to do maybe some spa consulting for any of their uniforms, how do they find you and where do they reach you?
The easiest way to reach me is just anthony@restoreclothing.com.
All right.
Okay, R-E-S-T-O-R-E clothing.com. So that's very kind of you to allow me to say that.
Yeah, of course. Come on now. That's what the radio is for. Yeah. I highly recommend. And anybody who has questions, particularly about textiles and sustainability and design, Anthony is your man. And that's all the time that we have. So thank you, Anthony, for being my guest.
Thank you
to Magnifico Radio engineer David Tatasciore. Thank you to Metro Jesus for the music, which you can also find on iTunes. And please visit Magnifico.com. Sign up for our newsletter. And thank you for listening. If you have any feedback, questions, or want to be a sponsor or recommend a guest, please email me at radio@Magnifico.com. Until next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.